Professor Pundit Public Nuisance. In his columns, books, and on social media, Jonathan Johnson is prolific. He likes to speak his mind about schools and universities, race, politics, and our complex South African society. He has brought incisive analysis, compassion, and a sense of humor to some of the most controversial issues in our country for many, many years. And now, in his memoir, Prof. Johnson goes back to his early days, growing up in a loving, fiercely evangelical family on the Cape Flats, being put on the road to a purpose by an inspiring teacher and becoming the first of his generation to go to university. In this episode of PageCast, Prof. Johnson is in conversation with award-winning journalist Rebecca Davis.
Welcome back to PageCast, Jonathan Ball's books podcast. I'm Rebecca Davis, journalist for the Daily Maverick, and it's my great pleasure to be here today with someone I think has officially reached the point where we can call you a national treasure, Professor Jonathan Johnson. You can't see, but he's crossing himself to acknowledge that compliment. Thank you so much for being with us today, Prof. And we're here to discuss your fantastic new memoir, Breaking Bread. And we are actually breaking bread as we speak, sort of. We have a, what would you call this?
Sort of a light harvest. Meal, yeah.
Yeah, harvest plate in front of us, which is quite delicious. Thank you, Jonathan Ball. So Jonathan's book is an account, I think it's easily the most personal book you've written so far, Breaking Bread.
No, that would be my mother's book, Song for Sarah.
Song for Sarah, stand corrected. Mm. Certainly of your recent publications, this is a departure from what you normally do, which is to write very incisively about education and curriculum matters. This is personal.
Mm.
Why now? Why a memoir?
Yeah, you know, I always thought of writing something this personal when I'm 70 or 80. And then I realized that I was in my late 60s, I was starting to forget stuff, yeah. And I always wanted to write from memory as much as possible. Mm. And being sort of egged on by Jill Moody, a really excellent editor here, Jonathan Ball, mm. I said, let me try this out, you know, and see how far it goes. So it wasn't my intention, but eventually I'm glad I did it. And what an enjoyable experience writing your life.
Mm. I love the idea of memoir writing as an act of defiance against forgetting, which is what you say, and I hope that it has served its purpose in that regard. Did you find it cathartic?
I did, especially the more difficult parts, the constant violence in your life from school to home to in the broader community. And I'd never quite spoken to anybody in depth about any of these things. And so in the process of writing, you're not just lifting a veil on your life, but you're also lifting some stuff, getting stuff off your chest, so to speak. And I found that very, very useful. And the more that happened, the more I enjoyed writing, the more I wanted to say things, you know. And so when close friends of mine say, like, this past weekend, I never thought he'd put that in there. That I probably wouldn't have if I wrote cold, but as I said, the process of writing enables you to share more and to share honestly, you know, about the things that shaped you.
Yeah. I think that readers are going to be intrigued by Breaking Bread, which I must say I found just engrossing from start to finish. Also hilarious. I did not realize you were this funny, Prof. It is a genuinely very funny book, particularly, I think, in the parts about your childhood, which you evoke so movingly at times as well, but also very, very vividly. I was really surprised to hear about the extent of your religious upbringing. I think a lot of people will be. Talk us through that a bit. There were parts of reading about your childhood where I felt genuinely very sorry for you. For instance, being forbidden from attending your own matric dance. That seems very harsh.
And if you grew up in a fundamentalist church, you know, in this case, fundamentalist evangelical church, everything was a no, right? Mm. Any sign of exuberance, any sign of pleasure, any sign of it would be taken down very quickly. So that's how I grew up. And it had a upside and a downside. The big upside was that growing up in a very dangerous part of the Cape Flats, I was in a bubble, largely sort of aware, but not you know, affected by. I mean, I never saw my parents fight. We never had a night without food. We never, you know, there was no smoking and drinking and all those kinds of things that, often destroyed families. So that was an upside for me, that I didn't go to prison. I didn't end up in trouble anywhere, you know, that kind of thing. The downside, of course, is you begin to get a very warped view of what the world is really like. You begin to think you're right and everybody else is wrong. You begin, especially in a church context, and simple things like going to, you know, my kids laugh endlessly when we tell them we couldn't go to the movies. You know, for them it's why, you know, but that's so much of the book is about how that fundamentalist faith constrains you, even as it protects you.
Yeah. I think you do a really good job of reflecting on the positives that you took out of what could otherwise seem like a very traumatic experience. I loved your account of how listening to sermons, for instance, has helped you shape your own public speaking and writing. But, I mean, a very repressive, very incredibly repressive sort of milieu, I would have thought, to have produced such a vibrant mind. I mean, what happened there?
Yeah, you know, the when you're in what some of my friends call a cult, when you're in a cult, you actually, your sense of normal is shaped by those experiences. So you don't think of yourself as odd, you know, until, of course, I grew up, went to university, started to learn about social justice and not just about, you know, being born again, having connected this really devout inner sense of yourself with a responsibility towards the poor, the hungry, the, you know. And one that became a big struggle for me, as you would have read in the book, between how do I, on the one hand, acknowledge the social gospel, as we used to call it, with this very, you know, internal, devout focus on God and me. Your citizenship is in heaven. You have nothing to do with the world around you. You know, just wait for the rapture. So how do you reconcile the sense of the devout and the sense of, you know, the of service? That was, I'm not sure I'm entirely sorted out with that intellectually, but I know I have a duty with the gifts that have been given to me to serve others, not just with your material possessions, which I happily give away, but with your own self, you know. And so you can see the connections there. As I said somewhere in the book, you know, I left the church, of course, as an institution, but in many ways it didn't leave me.
I was reflecting on the fact that you've sometimes been criticized for writing, for instance, in your regular columns, espousing views which some people think are sort of conservative respectability politics, in terms of, you know, young people pull up your pants and et cetera, et cetera. It was interesting to me to read your book because some of that really sort of made a lot more sense to me now, because you do write about the extent to which respectability policing was a huge part of that church. I mean, would you say that's something you have carried with you?
In a radical way. So I don't think of it as only a conservative, you know, trope. For me to say in a school that I work at in the mornings, in a working class school, that has the worst results are with respect to the matric results last year, I said two things to the kids. I said, number one, I know you come from a traumatized background. I know you are re-traumatized every time you come to school and you have to, you know, walk this gauntlet of gangsters and so on, and often uncles, foster parents, and so on. I acknowledge that. I see that, and I wanted to tell you I'll do anything, okay, to make sure that you are protected, that you are loved, that you're... So I do that. But I also say you still have to show up for school. You know, you still have to wear the school uniform. You still have to stop swearing at the teachers. You still have to... So for me, those two things can coexist. It's not original, but I like to borrow from somebody who calls this a radical empathy. So when you talk to some people, they will capture this sort of conservatism, you know, this sort of bowed by Raith as the center of the gods. But you talk to other people in this, and they say he's gone off the charts, you know. he's too radical for our liking, you know, he wants to. So the problem with, and you'd probably pick it up too, with if you read between the lines, is you can't really put me into a box. Mm-hmm. So if you call me colored, it's probably the only thing that will turn me semi-violent, you know, because I'm not. If you say I'm radical and liberal and so on, you'll see it's very difficult, mm-hmm. conservative. It's very difficult to put mm-hmm. me in any of those, because those are categories constructed for a particular purpose, but not all of us live our lives in boxes. Mm-hmm. So I'm quite comfortable being told that I'm all of those things, mm-hmm. but I also know that when you work with working-class children, as I do now and probably have most of my life, that if yours is only a pedagogy of love, they'll have you for breakfast for all three meals and the other two meals of the day. If it's only harshness, okay, you're no different from the uncle that kicks them on the weekend you know, and so on and so forth. So finding ways of expressing this radical empathy, of listening closely, of having dinner, as I do, with kids in the very dangerous parts of Lavendale and so on, and at the same time insisting that you can do well in your academics, I like that.
Yeah. There are darker elements, right? It's really striking, I think, the extent to which casual violence infused your childhood in terms of being beaten at home, being beaten at school, obviously very commonplace at the time, not at all frowned upon. I wasn't quite sure quite actually what your attitude about that now is, because you do also note that teachers have reported to you much higher levels of, you know, general misbehavior since corporal punishment was outlawed.
Yeah. No, I'm embarrassed to say, certainly when I started as a young teacher on the West Coast, you know, I use corporal punishment because that's all I knew, you know.
Look, you write about that, and I must say, I don't think anyone would blame you in the context you describe.
But it is embarrassing because, you know, and so by the time I got married, I mean, we were very clear that we will not lay our hands on our children under any circumstances, and that if you cannot get them to change their behavior by this very powerful gift that you have, which is a reason, then you shouldn't lay hands on them. And both of them are now in their 30s, and they will tell you, I think, that neither them or I ever ran up. But we talked a lot. Because, you know, the thing about corporal punishment, whether it's in the home or in the church or in the school, it leaves a mark on you, you know. You're not always aware of it, and that's how you get people saying stupid things like, you know, it was good for me, and look at how I turned out, you know. Well, that needs to be dissected. But yeah, so it did shape me. It did give me a particular kind of harshness, certainly in my young adult life. But it is something you learn very quickly as limited. Because I always just say to parents, when I do parent workshops, they say, you know, but I had no choice. So, you know, I had to beat this kid. And I said, did that solve anything? Did you have to beat them again 2 weeks later? And it turns out that this is the reality. You can't beat, you know, the bad out of kids or people. You've got to find another way of listening to them, of loving them, of setting the example for how to behave, which I bless I bring them on. And they will follow.
So here's something I think we should make quite a big deal of, because I think it could be singularly encouraging for many parents or underperforming learners listening to this or reading your book. And that is, I mean, I really do find this quite hard to believe, but you claim that you were totally average at school.
Yeah.
Totally average. Your school was boring and cruel. You were disengaged. You were in it for the soccer and messing around, etc. Can that really be true? Just a middling student?
I'll bring you my report cards. Seriously. And all the report cards would say, in fact, I had a clearing out a cupboard recently, and the report card says what every other report card says. This is not your potential. This is not what you really can do. Why are your marks underwater? You know, and I just wasn't studying until a confluence of factors, you know, just sort of plucked me and woke me up. You know, one is a great Latin teacher who told me I could do this stuff, and I really wanted to prove it. And I'm meeting a great friend who in the church, who was really a great student and went to a much better school academically. And you know, gradually just having adults around you were saying, come on, man, you know, you can do better, this and so on. So I was really lucky that all of those things happened at about the same time when I was about 16, I think. And then I studied hard. I studied over weekends. I wanted to prove this, particularly my Latin teacher, right, that I can do more than what I did. But up to that point, it, you know, I studied the night before, if at all.
Yeah.
And of course, your results would show it, you know. And I suspect this is why I became a teacher, is that I knew if the voice of one teacher could turn that on the average kid, just imagine if I had six classes of 30 children every day, what an incredible difference that can make to their lives if I could just convince them that they're smarter than they think.
Mm. I mean, your own experience is such a powerful illustration of the impact a single teacher can have on a life. You also go on to fail your first year at UWC, but for factors that seem not entirely academic.
It was not academic at all. Remember, I was at university in 1976. The students at UWC, where I was forced to go, had decided to declare solidarity with the students in Soweto. So they would come into our big science room and sort of say, classes are over, we are standing. I remember the first time Nicky Morgan said, we're declaring solidarity. Students in Soweto, I put up my hand and said, where's Soweto? Now nobody asked that question. But at that point, Southwestern Townships wasn't sort of something in the news, you know. And that plus my struggle with Scientific Afrikaans, I couldn't get it. Most of the lectures could only speak Afrikaans. And when they went into English, it was a disaster. So I couldn't figure out carbohydrates were coelhydrata, but I couldn't figure out how on earth hydrogen can be stuck stuff. You know, so you were studying twice at home. You were studying both the content and translating as you went along. And then, of course, the distance and the hardship financially of just getting to campus every day, which my parents couldn't afford. I lived in Retreat, Belleville, is way out in the northern suburbs. So it just became too hard. And of course, I failed.
You end up describing UWC as, quote, this ethnic institution that had caused me so much distress. Is that how you feel about it today still?
Yeah.
Your experience there?
So they send me every month to, they send a donation thing for two alumni. I won't give them a cent, you know. And it's not about particularly individuals. It's just about the fact that when I was there as a student, I had absolutely nothing to be grateful for, to be proud of, to be. I don't remember anything pleasant about my undergraduate experience. And that is why when I became a dean at the University of Pretoria, when I became a vice chancellor at the Free State, guess where all the money went? Undergraduate education. We sent them overseas. We gave them leadership training. We did everything. We fed them literally through the No Student Hungry campaign. Because I said to myself, you know, I don't want these students to have that experience that I had as undergrad. It's hard enough simply showing up with less than the money that you need. Why must you sickle? Why must you struggle with simple things, you know? The ice cream truck, we'd roll it onto campus, you know, in the summer and give everybody, you know, code. That's what I want every undergraduate student to experience, is the most important formative years in your youth, you know, from year it's work, you know. And so, yeah, so I often think I did those kinds of things to make sure that our students did have a much more positive experience in the first degree.
I love your revenge story about getting your master's in your master's of science and returning to shove it in the face of your miserable chemistry teacher.
Oh, yes, yes.
What a satisfying moment that must have been.
It was, you know, because the you know, what American education does to you, through, apart from making you competent, it gives you an enormous amount of confidence, which South African undergrad doesn't give you. I mean, to this day, I talk to people and say, put up your hand. If you had a professor that said something like this, you know, welcome to biochemistry 1, 2, 3, by the end of the first semester, half of you are gone. Do you know how many hands go up? So we have this bizarre sense in South Africa that you must make kids miserable, tell them that they failed before they even showed up. And so I came with an enormous amount of confidence. I knew my science, but I also knew myself much better. And so I could go to that doctor somebody and say to you, that those years you know, and the greatest teacher I've ever known, you know, and told him his story. And to my shock and horror, he just sat there in shock and horror. And then I went home.
I love that. All for it. One of your first jobs was at Traffs, Trafalgar High.
Hmm.
I was really intrigued by the suggestion from some of your colleagues that by performing so well as a teacher, you were in some way collaborating with the apartheid regime. What is the thinking there? Was it a common perception at the time?
I think so. Among a very small group of people, all of them at the time associated with a radical left group called the Unity Movement, which is a beautiful, intellectually, I mean, a beautiful movement, I have to say. But they came with a strange idea that if you work too hard, three or four colleagues, that you're making the system look good. Mm. And I said, but that can't be true. We're the last chance saloon for a lot of this work on lost kids between, you know, a higher qualification and just hopelessness, you know. And so I never quite figured that out, you know. But I went out of my way. I made sure every student, unlike my own experience, could do 12 experiments, you know, in a series, and do science rather than just learn it as most kids did those days. And I dare say even today, if you're in a poor and working class school, you're still more likely to learn science from the textbook than to do a titration or a dissection or a, you know, look through a microscope and so on. So I was so determined to do that. And but that was frowned upon in some quarters.
So very strange. I mean, different time, obviously.
Yeah.
Quite a wild idea. One of the things that comes through most clearly throughout the book, I think, is your prodigious work ethic that you seem to have inherited from your mother. 18-hour days.
Oh, easily. Yeah, easily. And the question people then ask is, do you have a life? And I do. You know, I get up at 11 o'clock to watch us lose by 1 point to the Argentinians in the rugby. I love athletics. I watch the Olympics. I read outside of my discipline just for fun. You know, we've got circles of friends. There's nothing better on a Friday night than the senseless banter about everything under the sun. No, I do. But when I sit down at work, you know. And, of course, because a lot of my work involves research and writing, it's done now so routinely that it doesn't feel like work. I don't have writer's block, thank God. You know, I can just sit down and imagine the world. Now, bear in mind also, if you are a columnist for 15 years for the Times, and they pay me well, you know, you better have something to say by 12 o'clock on Wednesday afternoon. And so I've also taught myself, just coming up the stairs to you today, I saw like six or seven things I can write about, but you wouldn't see it because you're coming to work, right? Mm. And so I quite enjoy being a amateur anthropologist, you know, just taking in the culture around me and trying to make sense of it.
Mm.
And if you see me unhappy, it's because I can't figure something out.
Mm.
When you see me happy, it's because I think I've handled something. So yeah, so being able to write 750 words every Thursday keeps me in the mode of writing, but also of thinking.
Yeah. You don't drink alcohol.
No.
I think that might be part of the plenty of productivity, to be honest. I was thinking about that. You say in your book that your two greatest passions in life are writing and eating.
Mm.
Do you have a favorite restaurant?
Oh, yes, I do. I mean, I've got a few favorite restaurants, but I still think the Burkhard Kombuis, not far from where we're sitting right now, probably makes the best curries on the planet, you know. And a lot of when I go there occasionally, you know, people would come and say, you taught me in grade 9 at Traff. So you taught. It's a wonderful experience, you know, so I think the Burkhard Kombuis is pretty good in terms of what it offers. I think Mythos on the Waterfront probably makes the best Greek food that I've ever eaten. And then if you want the best fish and chips, you know, you have to go, of course, to the Heart Bay Harbor, you know, that place. So, yeah, I mean, Cape Town is very blessed, you know, having, and I mean, I'm not a fussy person, but I love a good plate of food.
Mm.
And it doesn't have to be expensive, and there's a lot around here. In fact, I think, was it two restaurants? South Africa, two restaurants in the top 10 or 20 in the world the other day.
You've traveled a lot, obviously. Your time in America that you describe in Breaking Bread seems to have been incredibly energizing for you, but also opened your eyes, I think, to two things. Homophobia, you say, is one of them, that it changed your perspective on those kinds of social issues as well.
Yeah, you know, I don't recognize the America of today. They've gone nuts.
Yeah.
You know, seriously, it was so different when I was a student, because now you have this orange menace, right? I mean, people openly racist, openly xenophobic, openly, I mean, that is obviously not all Americans, but I'm just saying, I didn't have that sense. Having said that, when you live on Ivy League campuses, you tend to live with a fairly progressive community. So Cornell University, and I mean, my goodness me, what an incredible experience. And then in the Bay Area, of course, where Stanford University is located, you had to confront, as an evangelical Christian, rooted Christian, confront bigotries that you never had to do in the same way, you know, having made very close friends who were in that part of the world who were gay, and close friends who were Muslim, close friends who were, it just started to, and you know, sometimes it appears innocent, you know, it's quite devastating. I mean, I tell the story in the book, you know, of my mother, I don't know where she found the money to come see, witness the birth of her first child, and we had all of our African friends from Guinea and Congo and so on at our home, a little apartment. And as my mother came up the stairs, my friend from Congo with flowing robes, you know, says to my mother, "Welcome, my sister from Africa." And my mother says to him, "Thank you very much, but I'm not from Africa, I'm from Cape Town." You know, so, I mean, you had particular blinkers on you, you know. And that's why I believe that one of the best things that happened to humanity, and one of the best things that can happen to students, is to get out of here, to travel, to see the world, to listen to other cultures, other languages, other ways of seeing the world. It's probably the best education. If I had to have children again, and they said, "Dad, can we travel, or do you want us to go and study for a BA degree?" I'd say, "Yes, honey, get out of here, you know, see the world, and then come back."
Did you find South Africa seemed very sort of parochial on your return?
Yes, I was in trouble all the time. And you can imagine in the evangelical community in which I grew up, you were constantly in trouble, you know, because people had a scripture for everything from gay identity to Muslim faith, into the Muslim faith and so on, which I'm very embarrassed about, I have to say, when I think about those days. But you spoke too loud, you know, because, of course, if you didn't speak loud where we just came from, I mean, people just not see you, you know, and so on. So it was a very, very useful experience. And then, of course, you have to adjust to your own reality, because for me to connect to people in the work I do today in schools and universities, you have to meet people where they are. You can't be arrogant. You can't sort of say, "This is how I see the world." So I tend to hold back, especially in poorer communities where I work, working class communities, tend to hold back on what I believe, because it's actually quite irrelevant. So where are you? How do we meet each other halfway? How can I make sure you progress? How can I make sure your child has the best education possible? Because this is fundamentally why I live and why I do what I do, is the firm belief, I can back it up with any kind of evidence, that the only difference between a poor working class kid and a kid in a fancy school is opportunity.
Yeah.
There's no difference between, just trust me on this one, in terms of the ability to think and perform, there's no difference, right? And so I see my job as making sure, I mean, I love all kids, I've taught the range of children, and I will continue to do so, but my primary responsibility is to those that don't have fathers with networks, mothers with T groups and connections, you know, uncles and aunts. My primary job is to be that connector for these young people, so that they too can have the privilege of a good life.
Something I learned about you from this book is that you have a deep sense of personal mischief. I think perhaps never more on display than at your first day at the University of Pretoria. Boy, did you have some fun there.
Yeah, you know, life is short. Jesus is coming. Come on, man. You know, get out of here. I mean, one of the biggest problems you can have as an academic, especially, is to take yourself too seriously. You know, I'm very much aware of the fact that everything I have, everything I've done, is a consequence of living a life of grace, of being amongst people who have helped me every step along, black and white, spiritual. So if you take yourself too seriously, you know, you lose out on those joys that life brings, you know, like having an argument downstairs with a security guard, but why I need parking because you guys are waiting for me and there's going to be trouble, you know. And of course, these guys laugh because they've heard these silly jokes all over, but in the laughing, you know, we find common ground, you know. The joy of just talking to people, you know, like saying to the woman at the spa the other day, I'm a prophet, which of course I'm not. Said, you know, I'm a prophet, I can see things. She says, prophet, what do you see? I said, you're pregnant. She says, prophet, not even my mother knows. How do you know that? You know, so I said, okay, I'm out and I might look out on a limb here. And I said, well, I'm not done with the prophecy. She says, what prophet? I said, it's twins, and the poor woman.
Almost fainted.
We've become good friends since, fortunately. No, I mean, just imagine you are a teller and everybody abuses you, right? And it's 5 o'clock and you've worked the whole day. The person's only to laugh about it, for heaven's sake. You know, something just... And you were with me when I came in and the woman asked me downstairs. Oh, you were with too, yeah. You know how you do it? I said, really bad. She said, why? I said, oh, my fourth wife left me. Of course, it's nonsense, but she laughed.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully, it just feels a little lighter, mm-hmm. you know? And I love that, actually.
So, speaking of your one and only wife, having sex, she, it seems to me like she has been such an incredible grounding point and support for you throughout your life. I can't imagine how amazing it must have been, even as a graduate student in the States or whatever, to have had her with you too.
Yeah, we fortunately, you know, I went to graduate school when we shortly after we got married. So that was enormously useful, first of all, to have a companion. Secondly, she could work, you know, and we could earn some money and then drive our jalopy, old car, up and down the East Coast of America. At that time, she's really been the fixture in the house when it came to teaching the children values. I was the good cop. She was the bad cop. She would say, where's your report card or where's your homework? I would say, let's go get ice cream. And the reason was they had hell at school because of me. You know, the teacher would say, I can imagine, often at Pretoria Boys and Girls, where they were, why is your math mark so bad? Your dad is Professor Johnson. I can't tell you how that disturbed me, you know. So I always knew, don't put pressure on them. And their mother would, of course, take them one side and you know, tell them what could happen to them with the inheritance if they didn't love their socks or something like that.
It sounds like a winning dynamic. Pretoria was transformative, you're right, in terms of your personal journey of racial reconciliation. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, I go into the University of Pretoria. At that point, the university as a whole, the Faculty of Education, where I was dean in particular, was largely white, 90% white. Certainly education was 100% white, one or two black kids. And that plus the fact that I, you know, had a bit of a chip on my shoulder, sort of thought white people need to be brought to their senses, that kind of thing, which is really embarrassing when you think about how you thought those things. And then you work with these young people, you know, day in and day out, you know. And you go to their homes, you go to their churches, which I actually made an effort to do. Went to their sports camp, be invited to speak, believe it or not, at the Voortrekkers a few times. And the Afrikaner Bond. Scary experiences. And then you begin to realize, I won't give too much away from the book, that these are your people. They might, you know, lack certain kinds of pigmentation, but, you know, these are the people that you serve. These are the people that you love. These are the people that went out of their way over and over again to make sure that I was okay, that I was comfortable, and so on. So I fell in love with white kids, you know. I fell in love with all our kids and was privileged to serve them. To this day, I get WhatsApp messages from students that I taught and led at University of Pretoria and Free State. Just, they come to Cape Town, they call us up and we take them for coffee, you know, that kind of thing. So that, there were incidents, I won't repeat them now, in the book, of course, where it was so transformative that I literally had to go and sit down and take a take account of myself. And here's the nice thing about integrated lives. You know, you can't live with other people, love with other people, live with and learn from other people without being deeply transformed. Mm-hmm. So when people say to me in leadership workshops, what's the most important thing you want to share with us as leaders? I'd say to them, you can't presume to transform other people unless you have transformed yourself.
Right.
And I've walked that road.
You spent, I think, probably the majority of your time at the helm of South African universities at Afrikaans institutions. Is that right? The majority?
Not really. I mean, I was a dean at the University of Durban-Westville, which at that point was largely for Indian South Africans, and then integrated, thankfully. And then I was an administrator for about a year and a piece at two black universities. One was the Durban University of Technology, and the other was the Mangosuthu University of Technology, Umlazi. And then, of course, Free State and Pretoria and Free State in that order, et cetera. So it was a bit of a mixed bag, but I think the most things people remember would be things like rates at the University of the Free State. So that association is very strong.
Right.
And then Knowledge in the Blood is obviously a book about Pretoria.
Yeah.
So it got a bit more visibility in my research and writing than the others.
You do write that one of the issues that has kind of just eaten up your professional life is the issue of Afrikaans language.
Yeah.
This is sort of off the topic of the book, but I'm just curious as to your thoughts on the Bella Bill and whether the Bella Bill poses an actual threat to Afrikaans language schools.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't pose a threat to Afrikaans. I mean, you know, there are still people, unfortunately, in our country who still reference Afrikaans and its viability through the lens of a century ago, more than a century ago, the Boer War, you know, so they still think of Afrikaans as lost, in terms of loss, you know, and if you read the Afrikaans newspapers, which I no longer do, but I just did the other day, there's an inordinate amount of time of soul searching, of hand wringing, you know, which those of us who are non-Afrikaans speakers don't have a clue about, you know. So when the University of Stellenbosch, for example, decides to go Afrikaans, we were the first at the University of the Free State. People literally see it as an existential threat.
Yeah.
Because their identities are so closely tied up with what you and I might just think about as a language,
yeah,
right? For communication and so on. Mm-hmm. And so one of the research projects I really want to do, if I have time one day, is just having people write their biography of Afrikaans, how they lived with Afrikaans and so on. And in Stellenbosch, and in Free State, by the way, when people looked at me, you know, typically they would sort of say, I praat Afrikaans, that's clear. Well, it irritates me enormously. Just like I can't assume that you speak English or that you speak, you know. So people have a way of, and so I grew up with two kinds of Afrikaans. I grew up with the Afrikaans of the police knocking on the door looking for my brother to beat him up, you know. But I also grew up with the Afrikaans of my Montague relatives, which was the Lekker Afrikaans, which was Afrikaans freed from its political pretensions, which was an Afrikaans that wasn't arrogant, you know, and so on. But every now and again, you know, somebody reminds you of the ugly Afrikaans. That happened this week after somebody wrote, Marie Levita wrote a piece on this book. And then you just look at the commentary and you sort of say, my goodness me, the chauvinism, the racism, ugliness of Afrikaans, you know, and white people, the Afrikaans speakers who are Dutch traders, they don't understand black people. They don't understand, for example. If you said to me, what was the greatest damage done to the future of Afrikaans? It was 1976. You go to Soweto and you speak Afrikaans, you're playing with your life. You go up the road to Mamelodi and speak Afrikaans, you'll be fine. So there is a very strong attitude towards Afrikaans because people literally died. Kids died because of this attempt to extend Afrikaans across the curriculum in the 1970s. So, yeah, it's a sore story.
What is the one thing you would like people to take away from the book? I mean, obviously, it's not the kind of memoir where it's purely about, you know, your life. As always, with everything Jonathan Janssen created, I feel it stands for a lot more than that, doesn't it?
It does. And I suppose there's a lot in towards the final, I think the semi-final chapter before the coda. I sort of say, looking back across the archive ones, I have, what are three or four or five or six things I could share with you. Probably the most important one for young people that I would want them to get from this book is what I said earlier. You are incredibly talented. Yeah, you might not be at the science and math, you know, boffin, but you could be the arts and culture boffin. Yeah, you might, you know, but there's something in you that if a teacher finds out what that is and they work on it with you, you can become great in so many different ways. It's so, you know, apartheid's effects was to make both white people, give white people an exaggerated sense of incompetence and black people a completely, you know, negative sense of their abilities. That's a real, real problem, you know? And so I would love all our people to be able to read the book and say, I see parts of me in this book, and this is not a unique story. I can connect to chapter this or chapter that, but what I walk away with here is I can do more than this dude did, okay? If I just recognize what he's trying to sell me, which is, you're smarter than you think.
I love that. You write in conclusion that yours has been a life filled with gratitude, which I think is very clear from everything you write. But I also feel that we as South Africans should be filled with gratitude for you and the contributions that you have made. So thank you for that. And thank you for this wonderful book. And thanks for talking to us.
Thanks, Rebecca.
Thanks for listening to this episode of PageCast. We love hearing from you. So if you'd like to get in touch, please contact us at pagecastpodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, keep reading and listening.